We are nearing the end of the Easter season. Pentecost Sunday is on Sunday, and it seems as if the church is in a hurry to get a lot in before the end of the season. We're rapidly skipping through the book of the Acts of the Apostles. We skip whole chapters just to get further on, and then we return today and tomorrow to the last episode of Jesus' resurrection appearance to his disciples. I'd like to focus on this profound gospel, but before I do, let me just say a word about the selection from the Acts of the Apostles. As I say, we're skipping through this book pretty rapidly. And just picking out a few highlights of Paul's custody, a period of custody under the Roman authorities. Remember, the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem were accusing him of crimes, and he was trying to defend himself, but it didn't work out. And the Romans have been kind of taking him into protective custody because they don't really know what to do with him. Part of the lesson we can learn from this is, if you ever think that it seems as if the government doesn't know what it's doing, it's true. And this is true all the time. Governments don't really know what they're doing. They don't have all the answers. And so complex questions of international relations and what to do about social problems and what to do about complex accusations of crimes. Sometimes the government just spins its wheels trying to figure out what do we do. That's true now, and it was certainly true in Paul's time. He was held in Caesarea for over 2 years before he was even sent to Rome. And you get the impression from reading these later chapters of the Acts of the Apostles, you get the impression that they don't really know what to do. He's a Roman citizen, so they can't really punish him. Besides, he hasn't been convicted of any crimes, and yet they can't just let him go either, because he's got people who are out to kill him. You might know the story of how Paul got from Jerusalem to Caesarea. He was in Jerusalem, and there was all this commotion. And then a big group of Jews made a vow that they would not eat or drink until he was dead. And then the one who found out about it was the son of Paul's sister. But Paul's nephew goes to Paul in custody and says, hey, these people are going to kill you before the end of the day. And then Paul gets the word to the Romans, and the Roman centurion, or whoever the authority there, whisked him off in the middle of the night, brought him to Caesarea. So it's a good idea to keep him keep on good terms with your nieces and nephews, and they might save your life. Anyway, so the story is, Paul is in a kind of protective custody. He's not free, but he's not really in jail. He's just kind of under house arrest. And this continues for a long, long time. Now, when we recognize that we can't depend on governments to solve all our problems, it's not a reason to despair. It's a reason to put our trust in God. God is in charge. And sometimes it's even better when it's clear that no one else knows what he's doing, because we're not as tempted to think that we can look to world powers to solve our problems. If we think that governments can solve our problems, we might not turn to God as quickly. But as it is, if we're wise, we'll rely on God. And God works through human agents, for sure. He works through governments. He works through social institutions. But it's God at work. Okay, let's leave that aside. We'll be seeing Paul in Rome in tomorrow's reading. Let's turn to this passage in the end of John's Gospel. This is John chapter 21. If you're following the daily liturgy, you'll see a sudden shift here. In the Easter octave, we were reading about Jesus' appearances to his apostles after the resurrection. After the Easter octave, we started reading in the daily Gospels from John's Gospel. Not resurrection appearances, but all sorts of episodes from his public life. And now, today, and we did that up until yesterday. Yesterday we finished his discourse at the Last Supper. And then today we go back. Well, from the Last Supper, it's going forward. From the liturgical standpoint, we're going back to where we left off this passage back on Friday of the Octave of Easter. So 6 weeks ago, we were reading from John chapter 21, Jesus appearing on the shore when his disciples were in the boat fishing all night and not catching anything. So we're suddenly going back to this passage, and there's a lot of wisdom here. I would love to know if this tradition of breaking that passage up into two pieces and putting one in the octave of Easter and one at the very end of Easter, I would like to know how far back that goes. Maybe these selections were made just after the Second Vatican Council, I don't know. But maybe it's been the church's tradition for centuries to do it this way, I don't know. But I think one of the things we can see here is that in the early part of Easter, the point is to make it clear that Jesus is really alive, he's really bodily alive, he's really risen, because that took a while to sink in. But at the end of Easter, the focus here is not so much on proving that he's alive, because they've already accepted that. The shift is to what is the mission of the apostles now that it's clear that Jesus is risen. And so today we see Jesus renewing the mission of Simon Peter, and tomorrow we'll also get mention of the beloved disciple, John. So here's the personal encounter of Jesus and Simon Peter. Everybody else who was eating breakfast, they kind of disappear for a moment. And we just focus on Jesus and Peter. Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Very personal question. It's not the kind of thing you typically ask people. What is Jesus doing here? Well, he's opening a deeper level of the relationship with his chief apostle, the one who betrayed him, but who already repented and whom he already forgave. But he wants to reestablish the chief of the apostles in his mission. Typically, the answer when someone says, "I love you," is, "I love you too." You love me? Yes, I love you. I love you too. But that's not what happens here. Jesus wants to make Peter aware of what he's supposed to do for the flock. Maybe Peter would have thought, well, Jesus suffered for me, now I have to suffer for him. And after all, that was Jesus' instruction about the greatest kind of love there can be. There's no greater love than to lay down your life for your friend. Well, Jesus laid down his life for Peter, and Peter might have been thinking, now I'll have to lay down my life for him. And that's true, that comes up later in the passage. But before any of that, and before giving the idea that Jesus is going to give him a command or a duty, a responsibility, he puts it in the context of love. It's a beautiful way of doing it, actually. Because it's one thing to be responsible, to be obedient, to be submissive to authority, to follow commands. It's another thing to love and to act from the motive of love. So Jesus, instead of saying, do this, do this, do this, says, do you love me? Giving Peter an opportunity to say, yes, I love you. Jesus already knew it. And Peter knew that Jesus knew it. You know that I love you. But it gave Peter an opportunity to say it. I love you. You know I love you. A great opening that Jesus gave to Peter. And after Peter affirms his love, every time Jesus says, take care of my sheep, feed my lambs, tend my sheep. He says it three times. If you love me, take care of the flock. If you love me, do what I've been doing. If you love me, carry on my work. The work of the apostles is a work of love. It's but not love in the romantic sense or in the limited sense that we sometimes use for the word, but in the sense of making a gift of oneself in service of others. at the end, it says that Jesus gives him this further instruction after it's clear that he loves him, that he is willing to take on again the task of being the leader, of being the shepherd. And then he says, a time will come when you will be dressed by someone else and you will be led where you do not want to go. So sacrifice is part of the picture here, but it's in the context of love. You will submit yourself to this mistreatment, this death by which you will glorify God because of love. So that's where we're going in the Easter season. When we get to Pentecost, who comes down from heaven? Love, the Holy Spirit. What does he do? He sets the apostles on fire with love. He doesn't come down with commandments and duties and responsibilities. He comes down with the fire of love. And that's what we see being enkindled here on the seashore. Just as a little addendum, some of you joined us for our formation teaching yesterday, and we were studying Pope Francis's comments on St. Therese and her declaration that her vocation is love. Her vocation, she found her vocation in the heart of the church. She will be love. It's related to this. The vocation of someone who is set on fire by the Holy Spirit is love. How it's lived out in practice, well, there's as many different ways as there are people. But love is always at the heart. Love is always the key. So the question of Jesus to each one of us is always, do you love me? Do you love me? Knowing that we do love him, but giving us an opportunity to say that we love him and to show that we love him by the way we serve him.